Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Makerspace, a podcast run by Christian Education National. I'm Sam, and this week we have some time with Chris Watkin, lecturer and researcher at Monash University. He is also the author of the award-winning book, Biblical Critical Theory. This book explores how the Bible shapes our imaginations and cuts across many of the binaries that exist in our culture today. In this conversation, we talk about what we usually mean by critical theory and what it means to have a prophetic imagination and what it might mean that ultimate reality is personal. We're looking forward to hosting Chris at our AGM in March, but for now, here's my conversation with him as an appetizer. Welcome, Chris Watkin. It is really good to have you here and great to be able to speak with you on the podcast.
Sam, it's a real joy to be here.
Yeah, it's so great to have you here. And I think if anyone's like me and they've read your book, they've probably got a million questions about what you have to say. But interestingly, your work isn't primarily in theology, is it? It's in a different discipline.
Absolutely. My background is in French and German literature and philosophy, basically. My undergraduate degree was sort of half French, half German. And I loved it. Yeah, everything from the medieval period right up until the end of the 20th century, as it was then. We hadn't quite hit the 21st century by the time I graduated.
So would you say that you come at theology and you come at the Bible with more of a philosophical lens because of that?
That's a really interesting question. I think I come at theology and biblical studies from the point of view of a Christian sitting in the pews who wants to make sense of the Bible and to show how the Bible helps me make sense of the rest of my life, including the French and German literature. So I wouldn't say that philosophy was a way into theology, although I think it's helped me in some ways along the way. But really just being a, you know, quote unquote, normal Christian was probably my way into theology.
Sure. Well, that means they do exist. That's really good to know. So we're here to talk about your book, Biblical Critical Theory. And the thing with this book is it's done quite well. It's won awards. It's certainly been recommended by a lot of people. It's been reviewed really highly. And I imagine this is not the kind of attention that you were expecting, which is interesting. And I'm wondering, how has it been for you to have suddenly been platformed and to have all these different conversations because of that book? How has it been for you?
Well, you're right to say we weren't expecting it. It was versions of it were turned down by a number of publishers. And Alison, my wife, and I at one point were saying to each other, well, you know, we've tried and we haven't been able to get this out, so let's just shelve it. And then, you know, by God's grace, eventually, and the help of some people who sort of sacrificially went into bat for the book, it did get out. I think the experience has been a wonderful one, if I'm being honest. I just love speaking and thinking about how expansive and rich the Bible is. And the book doing well has given me lots and lots of opportunities to do just that. So I feel really grateful. I feel in my element. I love exploring just how the Bible speaks into different areas of society and different concerns that we have, and it's really opened a door for me to be able to do that. So yeah, I feel very grateful and humbled by the opportunity to have spent a couple of years doing quite a bit of that.
Oh, that's awesome. I had a question when I finished reading it. I wondered, was it always going to be called Biblical Critical Theory?
Yes, in the sense that that's a good question. No is the answer to the question. So we, as is the case with book titles, it's always a conversation between the author and the publisher. So I suggested a number of different titles, which with retrospect, I'm very glad the publisher didn't accept, because they really didn't sort of give a sense of what the book was going on about. And one of the ones that I suggested was, I think, a biblical critical theory, or a version of it. They said, that sounds really good. And then I was hesitant to begin with, But the more I thought about it, the more I'm convinced that is, in fact, what the book is doing. Critical theory understood in a broad sense, sort of everything post Kant in philosophy, and the very idea of critiquing a culture from a coherent standpoint outside that culture. And since I wrote the book, actually, and I've come to the conviction that that is a profoundly Christian thing to do, that the very enterprise that we call critical theory needs something very much like Christianity in order to be able to go forward robustly. So I'm glad that it was chosen, and I think it does describe what the book is doing, although I was hesitant to begin with.
Interesting. Yeah, I think when I got to the end of it, I thought, actually, this book is basically a biblical theology of culture. It's like a really good handbook just to be thinking through issues from a biblical framework. So it kind of operated like that. So I was really interested in the fact that it was is called biblical critical theory, because I'd say, you know, critical theory has had more attention now in the last 10 years than it ever has, in the popular space at least. And I was wondering, you know, were there any points where you thought maybe this isn't a good idea because it might be misunderstood? And do you think, just on the back of that, perhaps critical theory is often unfairly demonized? Often it's seen as the next boogeyman, perhaps after postmodernism or evolution or things like that. Is it something to be afraid of?
Well, it depends what you mean by critical theory. I think part of the problem is that there are different senses of it, and they're not always distinguished, and it's easy to slip from one to the other. The sense of critical theory that I grew up with in my undergraduate degree was all the different philosophies that after Immanuel Kant that try to set limits to the way to what we can know about the world. So pre-Kant, it was always pushing the limits, and then Kant said, hold on, wait a minute, do we really know, just to nerd out philosophically for 30 seconds, do we really know that space and time are things out there in the world? Might there be categories of our understanding? And it's exceedingly hard to show that they're not. And so from that point on, and this goes right through to the postmodern generation in the 1960s, we're always pulling in the limits of what we can know. We're critiquing more and more. Hold on, can we know that there is such a thing as truth and so forth? And so that was the sense of critical theory. And the unit that I did as an undergraduate called Modern Critical Theory was about that sort of stuff. And then this narrower sense of critical theory has emerged, I think, in the last, I don't know, 10 years or so, largely driven by critical race theory, which is a much narrower set of concerns and commitments. And I think the two have got conflated with each other. So the sense in which I'm using critical theory is a sense that would include Augustine's City of God, which is, you know, clearly not part of that very narrow sense of critical theory. But it's the sense of being able to take a step back from a culture of which you're part and therefore have somewhere to step back to. In other words, have a framework for understanding reality that's not exhaustively drawn from the culture you're in, to be able to look on that culture from that standpoint that's a step back from it and critique it. Like, say, as Augustine does in the City of God, when Rome says both this thing over here and that thing over there, it's being contradictory with itself, or this practice over there is abhorrent, and that one over there is sort of misguided, but you can see what they're trying to do. It's that sort of posture. And I think part of what would be really healthy to do would be to reclaim that greater sense of critical theory. And that's not politically inflected. There are versions of that that are happening on both the left and right. So perhaps the sort of more liberal version is the one that more readily comes to mind, critical race theory, things like that. But the position on the right that says that the problem is government and bureaucracy and waste, and what we need to do is aggressively go after that sort of thing is also a critical theory in that sense. Now, we don't use the term in that way, but I think that's our problem, not the inherent narrowness of the term. And so this broader Augustinian sense is the sense that I want to commend to Christians to think about and to develop a distinctively biblical way of doing.
Yeah, would that be similar to what Brueggemann is saying when he talks about the prophetic imagination? It's sort of this alternative consciousness which causes you to look at culture in a slightly dislocated or distanced kind of way to perhaps be better placed to critique it?
Yeah, I think so, with a caveat. So that the prophets are both a model for cultural critique and they're also unique because they're directly receiving the word of the Lord and passing it on to the society. Now, Hebrews 1 would say there's a similar dynamic at play with Christ. So we also have the word of the Lord in the scriptures revealed in Christ. But I don't think we can take everything that the prophets do and assume that our cultural critique will look just like that all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you're not supposed to take the words of Jeremiah and apply it to our time and space now and say, this is exactly what we'd be saying to the state now.
Yeah, look, as with many of these things, by seeking to avoid one pitfall, you can run headlong into another. So on the one hand, that there should be a caution, I think, to say as emphatically as the prophets do, this particular thing in our society is the thing that must be denounced. Sometimes it's clearer than others, but I think the way that the Bible talks about our own sinfulness and blind spots, and the way that the disciples continually put their foot in it as well, should caution us against having that sort of emphatic my way or the highway type attitude, which the prophets themselves didn't have. They often critiqued themselves as part of the problem as well. But if that's the only problem you're seeking to avoid, you're never going to have a critical voice at all, because you're always going to say, well, you know, I might be wrong and perhaps I ought not to speak out. And so you have to have both of those inadequate extremes in mind. You know, the church as a body does say uncomfortable things for all societies at some point, or should do. And if we're never making ourselves unpopular and never speaking out, then I think there's a problem with that. And the final point I'd make there is that I think this is a church thing rather than an individual Christian thing, not necessarily an institutional church, but it's something that's best done in community. So I have my own personal sort of expertise and blind spots and, you know, political preferences, and so do you. And by working with other Christians, we can arrive at a more adequate position that isn't in hock to any one person's blind spots. Part of this is working cross-culturally. So the Southeast Asian church or the Sub-Saharan African church is going to see holes in my understanding and my assumptions that I just don't see, and the people around me don't tell me about because they share them. And so the prophetic sort of vocation of the church today, or the vocation of critiquing culture, whether we put the label prophetic on it or not, I'm less certain, but it is something best done together, not individually.
And it seems to me where you're angling things towards the end of the book is that there are some ways in which we're quite attached to the state apparatus. We're quite complicit in the system. What do you think are some of the major temptations for Christian communities when it comes to maybe some of our blind spots and maybe some bandwagons we jump on, that actually when you are holding true to a narrative and the imagination of scripture, that you might actually want to think again about? What do you think some of those things might be for Australasia maybe?
The reason I hesitate is that I'm part of that culture, and so you're sort of asking me what are your own blind spots? It's always tricky, isn't it? I think one of them is probably the way in which we don't give the church, the body of Christ, the prominence that it has in the scriptures. One symptom of that is that we're very quick to read the yous of scripture as singular yous rather than plural yous. And when they're plural yous, we're not quite sure what to do with them. So, you know, when in Philippians 2, 12 and 13, it says, work out y'all's salvation with fear and trembling. So, oh, okay. Thought that was something that I was supposed to do individually. So I think pushing back against the sense that the basic unit of Christianity is the individual, and trying to lean into, I think, a much more New Testament view that the basic unit is the local church, is would be healthy for us as a culture. And the point I make in the book is that the two great temptations, I think, today are for churches to seek to remake themselves either in the image of a political activism group, or to remake themselves in the image of a corporate entity. And that those temptations will be different for different groups of Christians, and perhaps will change over time as well. So I think to be wary of selling out to either a state-focused view of what's important, i.e. politics is the whole horizon, that's the whole ballgame, or selling out to a corporate view where the thing that really matters is, yeah, caricaturally, are you growing in numbers? You know, how much money is coming in each month? And if those things are growing, then, well, we must be doing well as a church, because that's how the corporate world measures things.
Well, to have a bit of a crunching gear shift, near the beginning of the book, you start to talk about things that sound similar to the worldview conversation that's been going on. So I think probably emerging in the early 2000s, you had a renewed interest in Christian worldview studies, probably on the back of a lot of the new atheist movement and wanting to respond to that. But a lot of that stuff was, it'd be fair to say, quite cerebral, quite intellectual, very much just how can we rationally respond to things? How can we give the right answers and make sure we have the right thinking in place in response to some bad thinking, if we want to put it that way? What you've got at the start of your book is you actually start to frame things quite differently. You talk about figures and ground. And then you go in to talk about these figures. And from what I can understand, what you're saying is, as human beings, the way that we actually apprehend the world and the way that we move through it is not a case of moving from a rational place into action, but we're influenced by a whole bunch of different figures, like relationships and behavior and objects and language and stories. And so I wondered if you could talk to the complexity of what it means to have a worldview, if we want to use that word, you know, in a helpful way, and that's more reflective of what it actually means to be human rather than just having Christian ideas.
I'd love to. Yeah, I think this is a really, a really helpful idea, largely because it's easy to go through the whole of life not really realizing that you have a perspective, that your take on things has a history, like the way that we see things now and the assumptions that modern people have. You can see where those things began and you can trace them through. And I think often to people, both Christians and non-Christians, that's quite revelatory. The idea that what I think about, I don't know, beauty, whatever, you can see where that way of thinking began. And there was a time when people didn't think like that. I just thought that was the way everybody thought. I just thought that was common sense. So really, really helpful, I think, for people, whatever their commitments, to go through this process. These ideas of figures are trying to not let any one way that we apprehend the world dominate all the others. So one problem with worldview thinking when it's done badly, and it's not always done badly, is that the idea is that we're fundamentally ideas machines. And then there's some other stuff that sort of flows downstream of that. But fundamentally, you can understand a person most adequately if you know what ideas are in their head. And then there's pushback against that in different ways, saying, no, it's not about ideas. It's about this other thing. That's the main way that we understand human beings. And what I'm trying to do in the introduction is to say there's no one figure, no one way of understanding human beings, whether it's the ideas in our heads or our daily rituals and habits or the institutions in our society or the stories that we use to make sense of ourselves, that dominates all the others, that you can say that's the one thing. It's not to say that they're all equal, but it's to say that the interactions with them are complex and we can't just assume that one of them is leading all the others. And
Read between the lines there, that sounds like you're very aware of some of the way that the conversation is ping-ponged from maybe perhaps going, no, it's not about our ideas, it's about our desires. Well, no, it's not about our desires, it's about our practices, and the way that those kind of get ping-ponged around the place. And what you're saying is, no, they actually all have a place. They might have different levels of influence, but they all have a place and we need to pay attention to all of it.
Yeah, absolutely. That's it.
Okay, glad I understand it. Okay, no, that's very interesting because there, obviously it's a big ongoing discussion. And I think one of the other discussions is, well, if we don't use worldview, what do we say? And so we've got, you know, people maybe throwing around, you know, Charles Taylor's social imaginary, but again, that can be confusing for people as well because it sounds like imagination and things like that. So the worldview conversation is fairly complex.
Yeah, so in the introduction again, I end up with the idea of world, that we each have a world. And the reason that I chose that is that it has the great virtue of being ordinary language. So we're not inventing yet another technical term because it's an ordinary thing. Like everybody has a way that we see things, a way that we understand and intuit and feel about the world. So it's not some sort of dusty philosophical concept. We all walk around with one of these all the time. And so having a normal word for it is, I think, preferable. And we use the idea of world in ways that I think help us to grasp what's going on. So, you know, we'll talk about the world of Star Wars, by which we mean, you know, all the sort of fan fiction online and the way that people dress up and the language that you use and the conventions that you go to. It's a whole way of being in the world that's part of this idea of Star Wars. And in the same way, we each have one of these worlds, and it'll be, you know, perhaps I might be a Star Wars fan, or I might be into a particular sports team. And these different affiliations that I have shape my sense of what I guess you could say, what I see when I look out into the world. And I think part of this idea of worlds is that we see different things. It's not just that we have different ideas. Let's start with the phenomenon of eyewitness reports. So there's lots of research out there that says two people can witness the same car crash or, you know, demonstration in the streets and give very, very different reports about it, which would make you think, well, have you actually seen the same thing at all? But it's because our sensitivities and what we notice is conditioned by so many different things, and there's so much out there to notice, and we can only notice a fraction of it, that often the world looks very different to different people, even if they're looking out at the same world out there. And I think that realization that I'm always making choices about what I pay attention to, and again, there's data to show that the amount of information sort of striking my senses in any second compared to the amount of information that my brain can process, the ratio is, you know, a huge number to a very tiny number. So attention is essentially the art of ignoring almost everything. Like what tiny fraction of all the stuff going on in the culture at the moment am I going to pay attention to? You know, and algorithms are very sort of into that. They teach us, they catechize us in what they think we should pay attention to, and often we just go with the flow and let the algorithm decide for us. But whether it's us deciding or the algorithm deciding, we're choosing to ignore most of what's going on. And then that little bit that is left over at the end, that's our world.
Very interesting. Well, again, another really helpful tool that you have throughout the book is this idea of diagonalization. And you talk about how in culture or in society, we often have certain binaries set up, and it's almost like we're asked to choose one or the other. So, for instance, one of those binaries might be the community or the many or the individual or the one. So the one or the many, are we community or are we individual? And so what you're saying is often the biblical story cuts through these things. It's like a diagonal, and it says, no, it's not one or the other. It's both, but also it transcends both of those things. So in that instance, it's the Trinity, for instance, brings both those things together, and it offers us something quite different. So if someone was to pick up your book and they were to look at your concept of diagonalization, you know, what might you say to help them understand that a little bit more?
I am trying to put my finger on something that Christians have been saying for 2,000 years, I think, certainly since Augustine. But it's often a bit difficult to spot because it doesn't have a label. And so diagonalization is just putting a label on it. And it's the idea that only God has really fresh creative ideas, and he made everything. We don't live in two equal creations. Like, God made the first creation, then, you know, I don't know, the devil made the second creation and they're equal. That's not the world we live in. Everything is originally God's, and everything that departs from God, that is sinful, is a twisting and a diminution and a poorer version of something that God made. And if that's true, and I think Genesis 1-3 show that it is, then we would expect any culture to have sort of partial, twisted, dismembered, out of context bits of truth in it, rather than completely creative new ideas of its own. And certainly in our modern Western culture, I think that's what we do see. So very often the great debates that animate our society, either on a philosophical level or on a cultural level, are taking, cherry-picking bits of biblical truth, ripping them out of context, twisting them, and then setting themselves up against each other as in, you've got to choose one of these two things. Like, you know, are you for, just to use the example that you introduced there, you know, individual or collective? And of course, the Trinity is not an afterthought. So you don't start with, well, there's the individual over here and there's a collective over here. Oh my goodness, what are we going to do? Hey, let's invent the Trinity to sort of be neither of those. No, the Trinity comes first, where God is one God in three persons. There's both diversity and plurality and unity. They're in beautiful harmony. It's not as if the Trinity are fighting like rats in a sack, you know, trying to, well, it's unity. No, it's not. It's diversity. No, there's a wonderful symphonic harmony about that. And then what modern society has seen fit to do on one reading is to oppose these two principles to each other. So you've got the one and you've got the many. And this goes all the way back, you know, to pre-Socratic philosophers. And how do we get those two to play nicely together? Well, the history of 3,000 years of philosophy is you can't. They don't play nicely together. And so to diagonalize that opposition is to say, hey, do you know what's happening here? These two things that we're forcing ourselves to choose between are actually two partial and dismembered limbs that have been chopped off a beautiful body, which is the body of the Trinity. And so I'm not going to choose between them. I'm going to show you what they're both part of. So it's not some sort of wishy-washy meeting in the middle. You know, let's have half of one and half of the other. Or let's just try and keep everyone happy. It's in a sense making everyone unhappy, because you're saying to both of those positions, you're actually a heresy. And the truth is bigger than you realize. And what you think is the whole truth is actually a twisted version of part of the truth.
Love it. That's such a nice, succinct way of putting it. Well, you've mentioned the Trinity there quite a bit, and I find that fascinating, especially in the Christian education space around knowledge and what we can know, because you make a claim which I think is pretty important and confronting if you take it seriously, which is ultimate reality is personal and it's relational. Now, when you're in the education space, sometimes the binaries there can be either knowledge is simply discovered or it's simply constructed. But what you're saying is, no, well, if it's relational, then it's actually revealed. There's someone behind it. Now, in my mind, my alarm bells are going off because I'm thinking that's really big and we need to talk about that. What would you say to a Christian teacher to say, look, this has massive implications. If all of reality is relational, if Christ does hold all things together, what difference does it make for learning about algorithms? And what difference does it make for, you know, learning how to give a speech or how to build your skill in sports? You know, how is Christ related to that?
It's a brilliant question. I'm not sure that I can do it justice, but let me have a go. Let's start with something that's relatively uncontroversial and then build out to those examples that you gave. So knowing a person, how do we know a person? Well, you could conceive that the way that I would get to know you, Sam, would be to torture you so that I force you to tell me about yourself. And then surely that would be the best way because you couldn't possibly, you know, resist that torture. Well, actually, no, that would be an incredibly impoverished way because whatever you would tell me under torture would likely not really reveal, you know, the depths of yourself. It would be, you know, what was coerced out of you. But neither do I just sit there and not engage with you at all. The way that I find out about you is, you know, we go out for coffee. I sort of meet you in different circumstances. I'd ask you a bunch of questions. I'd let you ask me a bunch of questions. You know, we'd hang out. And that way, I'd get to know you in a much richer and deeper way than either if I tortured you or just said nothing. One of the dominant modern ways of understanding how we know things is going back to Francis Bacon and René Descartes, a version of this torture paradigm. So Bacon at one point says that nature, and I can't remember the exact words of the quotation, we need to torture nature on the rack so that she reveals her secrets, something like that. And Descartes says we are masters and possessors of nature. So what it means to know something is to dominate it and own it, which is a slightly more cuddly version of this torture paradigm. And out of that, you get the tradition of critique. So the way I know something is I interrogate it to death. I critique it until I can't critique it anymore. And what's left is what I can know of it. And that's a dominant way of finding things out today. And there's also the sort of caricaturally relativist way of knowing things, which is much closer to the just sitting there and not asking you anything. Well, you know, we can't know, so why are we going to bother? But I think the paradigm that comes from the Bible, and I got this from the philosopher Esther Meek in her two books.
We've actually had her on this podcast as well.
Oh, did you? Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
That's brilliant. I would love more people to know about her work. I think it's really profound because what she does, I think, I haven't talked to her about this and she might disagree. This is my sense of what she does. She closes the doors on the culture. She says, okay, fine. Culture's got its ways of knowing things. Let's just bracket those and put them to one side for a moment. Let's open the Bible and assume that we don't know anything about how we know things and just try and build up an epistemology, a way of accounting for how we know stuff just from the Bible. Just, you know, just as an experiment. Let's see what happens when we do that. And what she comes up with when she does that is this sense of what she calls covenant epistemology, which is that we know things on this paradigm of personal knowledge. So the way that I know a person is by letting themselves reveal themselves to me, by being open to that and asking the right questions and then, you know, shutting up and letting the answers come forth. And actually she says that the way that we know everything, the impersonal things as well, is fundamentally on that paradigm, not by torturing them to death, but by being open to a call and response sort of antiphony with them.
Mm.
And I don't want that to come over as some sort of wishy-washy or even new age, oh, you know, just let the stone speak to you type thing. That's a caricature of this position. What I think it is a position that is fundamentally cutting with the grain of a universe that, as it happens, was created by a personal God. And as the Bible tells us consistently, points us to him. The heavens declare the glory of God. And the way that God has made the world, you know, this is Paul in Romans 1, you can see his eternal power and divine nature. It's clear by what has been made, so that people are without excuse. So if that is true, if those Bible verses are true, surely that should have some purchase on the way that we go about this project of knowing things. And I think that's what Esther Meek is brilliantly capturing and trying to do. So personal knowledge doesn't mean that, you know, I'm going to have a conversation with the stone in order to know the stone. It means that the stone speaks in the way that the psalm talks about the heavens declaring of the personal God who made it. And if I don't see it in that context, I'm missing the fundamental thing about understanding this stone as it really is in reality. Now, how that teases itself out in terms of algorithms and so forth is where I'm less clear. What I would say about things like algorithms, and this is a different point, I'm afraid, is that the great gift of coming at knowledge from a Christian point of view is that we have the creation, fall, redemption, consummation framework. So the moment of history that we're in now is neither how things originally were made, nor is it how they will eventually end up. And in order to understand anything adequately in the present, we must understand it in terms of that story. What are the echoes here of God's original good creation? How have those been twisted and dismembered? Because everything in this present age is touched by sin. And how can these things be redeemed? And each of those are rich and deep questions. There aren't easy answers to any of those. So if I did want to try and understand, okay, so what about algorithms? That's the framework that I would use. But I don't know, because I haven't sort of taken time to think about algorithms specifically in that way. I don't know exactly what I would say, but that's how I go about it.
Sure. Oh, that's really helpful. Well, you've mentioned the epistemology and the interrogation of the universe, or I think the language you use in your book is, it's like pinning a butterfly to a display board. So maybe this could be the final question. Would be, you mention there that we treat the Bible like this, and this book being biblical critical theory. It seems what you're saying is, the Bible is not what we want to use it for sometimes. It is not a tool that we just get to roll out conveniently to just back up whatever frameworks or ideas or concepts we like. It seems that you want to argue actually there's a certain strangeness to the Bible. So I wonder, just to maybe finish off our conversation, how then would you encourage people to approach the Bible in order to retain its sort of its otherness in a way, and to let it kind of structure our lives, that we might understand or stand under the Bible and let it frame our imaginations rather than projecting onto it what we want? What is the Bible? How should we read it?
Well, I guess a full orbed answer to that question that we, perhaps we don't have time for in the podcast, would always start with what the Bible says about itself. Like, if you're going to take the Bible seriously, surely you should let the Bible set the agenda for how you read the Bible. And you'd be looking at verses like, you know, 2 Timothy 3:16, all scriptures God breathed and is useful. Very interesting that it doesn't say all scriptures God breathed and is interesting. there's something important there about the way that the Bible is to be read. And you know, there'd be lots of other verses that you want to bring to bear. In terms of the little bit of the answer to that question that I can provide right now, in my own way that I read the Bible, and what I would seek to commend to others, is to have what you could think of as a big Bible. In other words, we we shrink the Bible down terribly. You know, so we take something like the resurrection and we, and this is a caricature. I don't think anyone does this fully, but this is perhaps the tendency that we feel pulled in. Well, the resurrection is all about, you know, are Jesus' claims true? Well, he really rose, so we know that they are. And it sort of validates the cross, and we have this quite emaciated sense of the resurrection. But I think what Paul is drawing us into in 1 Corinthians 15 is a sense of the resurrection that completely overturns everything we thought was true about reality. So, for example, I lost my father about a year and a half ago now, and death is very, very bitter, and it casts a very long shadow, and it never goes away. And death is eventually the pin that bursts all our balloons. You know, I can have ambition, I can have compassion, whatever it is, eventually that will run into the buffers of death. And if we don't think that the Bible is true, eventually everything will run into the buffers of death, either in the heat death of the universe or sooner if we blow ourselves up or destroy the world or whatever. So essentially, if you don't believe in the resurrection, both on a personal level and probably on a societal level as well, this is as good as it's ever going to get. Everything's going to go down. It's certainly at my age, my body's just going to go downhill. It's not getting better anymore. So it's never going to be as good for me as it is now. But if as Christians we embrace a big resurrection, the sort of audacity of dancing on the grave of death type 1 Corinthians 15 view of the resurrection, then we live in a universe where the one limit to end all limits has been lifted. Like, death is not a limit anymore. Mm. There isn't a final pin that will burst every single balloon of ambition or compassion that I have, actually, because I'm going to sail through death. It's extraordinary even to say those words. Not because of anything that I'm not clever, I'm not strong, but because of one who defeated death for me. And what it feels like to live in the light of that reality is sort of black and white different to what it feels like to live in the first sort of reality. So for me, you know, as my body very gradually is wearing out, this is as bad as it's ever going to be for me, because the future is a future of a resurrected body and freedom from the presence of sin, thank goodness, and knowing my Savior face to face. So this is a fundamentally hopeful way of being in the world. And if we let the resurrection shape us on that fundamental level, and all the other doctrines of the Bible, I just picked on the resurrection because it's the first one that came to mind. But if we allow the Bible to be big in that way, and not just have the resurrection as an idea or a doctrine, but as a way that shapes our sense of what it's like to be in the world, then I think we're reading the Bible in a way that begins in some small way to actually do the Bible justice, because it is a much bigger book than any of us, including myself, realize. And you know, we've begun to scratch the surface of it, but there are sort of huge tracts of the way that the Bible gets deep into our sense of who we are and how the world is and how to live in it, that I don't think we've, you know, even in 2000 years, we haven't got down to yet. So we've got work to do.
I mean, I love what you're saying, and I think in relation to death too, and it seems to me that, you know, the proper response to the resurrection and the story that sits behind it is joy is rational and hope isn't without cause. You're like, it totally reframes the entire way you approach meaning and grief and love. I mean, love is not irrational because it endures. Something goes beyond death. So it's beautiful.
And it gives you a particular sort of hope as well. So I think that there are different hopes in society at the moment. There's the run round like a headless chicken. Perhaps if we work hard enough, we will make everything perfect sort of hope, which you can sustain for a period, but eventually I think becomes cynicism. And there's cynicism itself. But I think the idea of a hope that can keep its eyes open and doesn't have to romanticize, can look death in the face and see beyond it and not seek to make everything right immediately and then burn out, but play the long game. And this is the end of 1 Corinthians 15, the last verse. Is it verse 58? Just one of the most brilliant verses in the Bible. So Paul has spent like 57 verses or something like that, you know, dancing up and down on death's grave and sort of blowing raspberries at death. And then he comes to the end of 1 Corinthians 15. You think, you know, how's he going to land this? So therefore, you know, brothers and sisters, rejoice and be happy or something like that. And basically, the final verse of that chapter is, you know, something to the effect of, get up out of bed tomorrow morning, drag a comb across your hair, throw some coffee down your neck, get on with it, roll your sleeves up and do something. I get to work. And it's that sense of hopeful working on the thing that's in front of me in light of the fact that death has been defeated. That it's that being able to hold the cosmic vision and the immediate together that I think that's a distinctive of Christian hope.
100%. Well, that is a beautiful way to finish our conversation. So thank you for spending time unpacking that sort of stuff. And we really look forward to having you at our AGM in next month now. So it'll be great to see you there and look forward to what you have to say.
I'm looking forward to it too, Sam. I'm sure I'll learn a lot. And yeah, looking forward to being with you guys.
Brilliant. Thanks a lot. Cheers.
God bless.
Thanks for joining. If you're keen to keep learning and accessing more of CEN's resources, why not subscribe to the Christian Teachers Journal, a publication of the National Institute for Christian Education, the postgraduate arm of CEN. Go to CEN's website, which is in the show notes, and under publications, you can take out an annual subscription to CTJ and receive your own copy of the 4 editions. From time to time, you might even find some writing from our podcast guests. See you next time.